on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with author Suzanne Mettler about her book, The Submerged State, How Invisible Government Policies Undermine American Democracy. All of this privatization, we're going to be talking about this tonight, this whole privatization scheme, all of the services that we get that we think, that's a private for-profit interest. They're providing that service. No, it's actually a government service that the Republicans and a lot of Bentney Democrats have gone, let's outsource that so we don't have to hire those workers so that we can push that out there and let it be someone else's problem. But at the end of it, it's still something that we, the people, have to have done. It's something that something we need. What's happened over the years, and she's going to talk about this extensively, is we've now seemed to think that the things that are being done are no longer being done by us, that they're done by these benevolent corporations. Not necessarily the truth. Also in the second hour, we're going to talk with Ken Wood, Teamsters International Vice President and President of Teamsters Local 79 down in Tampa. We've been talking about this for a while. Florida's looking at privatizing their prison system, and the Teamsters have filed ethics charges with the Ethics Commission down there in Florida. I got to be honest, I didn't even know Florida had an Ethics Commission. And if they do, and evidently they do, really? Where have you been? Where have you been for the longest time? Also in the second hour, Edward Payne, an unemployed worker and the leader of Fight for Philadelphia, are going to be here talking about unemployment. There was a rally held today here in Harrisburg. A number of unemployed workers took to Senator Toomey's office and said, hey, you ran on jobs, jobs, jobs. Where are they? Interesting conversation I had with the police, though. A couple of the building police came down, to watch over, and I generally go over and try and gauge how they're going to be. And the one cop told me that Toomey has never been in his office. They have never seen him. And I guess it's kind of a running joke that he's never been in the Harrisburg office. So kind of one of those things where you go, why bother have the office at all? And in the third hour, Camille Rivera is going to be here with United New York, going to be here talking about their Beyond May 12th coalition. Evidently, they're going to have a march next week. They're going to combine this with a solidarity movement with the folks who are occupying Wall Street. And this Occupy Wall Street is really beginning to take hold. Because I think what's happening is it's getting some direction. It's what we've been talking about for some time. Once they start to figure out what it is that they want, what direction we should be going, I think you're going to see people following along. You know, and stop with the radical self-interest. Start talking about maybe a transaction tax on Wall Street so that that money goes back into the coffers and begins to pay for social programs and education and infrastructure. Good start. Maybe a fair and balanced tax code so that the wealthy pay a little bit more. Maybe a good start. Maybe talking about some trade policies that are going to benefit the country. I think that's the direction to go. I think I saw Occupy Kentucky, Occupy Los Angeles. There's talk of one in Philadelphia. So there's some definite movement happening here. So we are going to be keeping an eye on that as this and reporting with folks from there, from the different locations as this goes on, because this is a big story. This is important. Anyway, today, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. On all of this, if you got a question, comment, something you want to talk to the guests, feel free to give us a call and let them know what your thoughts are. So, we are absolutely turning into privatization nation. You may remember back in July, Governor Corbett said he was going to come out with a commission. And it would be formed at his discretion and his direction, and they would examine from, in his words, from soup to nuts, all state assets and all state services. So anything that the state owns, maybe we can put it on the auction block. Maybe we can hock it off for a couple of pennies. And anything that the state does, maybe those services, we're going to privatize those. Well, today, the Corbett administration has finally announced the long-anticipated, long-awaited task force on government privatization and efficiency. The task force is expected to meet for the very first time sometime late in October. I'm going to guess Halloween because these are some scary folks. And here's the thing. The task force doesn't have like a goal. Their goal is continuous destruction. Their goal is continuous outsourcing, continuous privatization, continuous auctioneering. Understand, continuous, it's kind of code for they're going to be looking for new ways to steal taxpayer assets for an indefinite amount of time. I shouldn't say indefinite, not indefinite, just until we can get Corbett out of office. But there are going to be no in-depth reports coming out, nothing that we can look for, no fascinating analysis. This is going to be constant, hey, there's some things here, let's get rid of that. It's not going to be like the Marcellus Shale Commission, not going to be like that, where there's actually a report and this is what we debate about, not going to be that. Not like the Transportation Funding Commission in their report, didn't agree with much in there either. And certainly not like the liquor scheme, which I think we're still waiting on the liquor scheme. I think they're holding that back because there's part of me that thinks what's in there not going to make them happy. But I was looking at the commission, and the commission is basically a right-winger inside group. It's the who's who of right-wing insiders, the who's who of big campaign donors, special interests, and, of course, got to have your little flavor of political patronage in there as well. And I guess the question is, what did you expect? Did you really think that this would be a bipartisan commission of people who go, well, wait a second. Did you think you were going to see Dave Filman, the head of AFSCME Council 13, on the commission, say, well, wait a second. Our members do this and do it much more efficiently than what you're proposing. No, you're not going to see that. What you saw is you saw a Republican big money man from the Philadelphia area, a guy named Bob Asher. He's on it. Big campaign contributor, a little payback maybe. And the bald guy from the Tea Party Twizzle tank over there, the Tea Twit tank, the Commonwealth Foundation. Briette's on there. And I go, why is he there? He's nothing but a right-wing political hack. I mean, there's nothing scientific. There's nothing actually reviewed about anything that they put out over there. Yet he's on the commission. And some of the other names are, just blows to the past. Melissa Hart, who, people call Rick Santorum in a skirt, she's a former congresswoman. Again, way out on the privatization, way out on the edge. Former PLC PLCB boss Jonathan Newman, again, a guy who wants to privatize the liquor store. So, yeah, let's have privatization, yeah. And, of course, school choice honcho Joe Watkins. So you got to have your liquor store. You got to have your education. You got to get all that stuff out of there. And you go down the list, you know, people from the Department of Community and Economic Development, former Secretary Oblonsky, the head of the Republican Party in Allegheny County, he's there. One of the big lobbyists from Quantum Communications, Charlie Giroux, he's there. I mean, you've got all these, the who's who of how do we destroy government, the who's who of what can we sell off, the who's who of political insider. I look at Representative Robert Walker. He was the congressman down at Pitts District, I think the 16th. One of the guys who, during his tenure, and this is important, this is the mindset here, during his tenure, pushed for the most stringent, the most harsh, the most lengthy drug sentences you could come up with. And yet, this is a guy on this. And you know he's pushing for prison privatization. You know it. And of course, you can't have one of these commissions without a CEO of a healthcare company. You had to have that. There's Sue Schick, the CEO of United Healthcare. She's there. You got the president of a right-wing college, Grove City College, all out there. And what they're going to do is they're going to explore if there are any functions now performed by the state that would be better and more cost-effectively performed in the private sector. I'll bet you bottom dollar, bottom line dollar, that if you were to ask them, name one thing that the public sector does better than the private sector, I don't know that they could come up with anything. Because what we're talking about right now, they want to take a whack at education. They want to privatize, profitize public education. They want to destroy it. The liquor stores, they've already told you, we're gonna sell those off. And they keep making up numbers. Every time I turn around, there's a new number. I guess it's like a bingo game. Which one shall I pick? Because it's going to be none of them. You know we're not going to get anything for our asset. And you're going to have liquor stores on every corner. And we're going to end up like states who have some serious problems. And you know what it's going to do? It's going to cost us a ton more money down the road in all of the negative categories. But, hey, you know, at least we, you know, it's not a core government function. And look at these transportation bills, privatization, P3s, public-private partnerships. Oh, I've got to take that public money, get it out there, and get those private corporations owning our infrastructure. There's talk of privatizing the lottery. You know, the thing that's supposed to help Pennsylvania seniors? Well, they want to profitize that. I've heard even talk of privatizing our state parks. So if you want to go to the state park, you got to dig in your pocket. As for now, you go. It's part of your, you know, this is part of the state. I've even, you know, again, here in Harrisburg, with all that's going on, they want to privatize the parking garages still. There's still talk, I hear. In Chicago, for instance, they privatize not only their parking garages, but also the enforcement and the meters. Pittsburgh's doing the same thing. North Carolina, they want to privatize their aquariums. Where does it end? And if we're going to go down this path, and I've been thinking about this. If we're going to go down the privatization path, what the heck? Let's just privatize our legislature. Maybe privatize the governor's house. Let's sell the governor's house off. Let him pay rent like everybody else has to. Maybe privatize the governor's office. Maybe we can hire out for a better governor. At the end of this, where do we stop? Because once you privatize this, and I go back to the story of the guy I met in Wisconsin, and again, it's exactly the reality of the world we live in. And I'll never forget it. I went and I got my oil change, and I've told this story a couple of times before. And the guy in front of me was a state worker who was going to retire. He was going to collect his pension, and he was going to work for a for-profit private company doing the exact same job at twice as much money. And the guy behind the counter, the guy who, I think he owned the gas station, was angry that the guy was retiring with a pension. He wasn't angry that the job that was being done for the state was going to cost twice as much. That didn't enter into his thought process. What entered into his head is, well, he's going to retire with a pension. Not the fact that that job that he was doing for half the price, half, that never crossed his mind. And, you know, for 6 years, I've been on the air here. And I've been asking, show me a privatization scheme that has actually saved, over the long term, that has actually saved the taxpayers any money, that has actually delivered on what it's supposed to do. And I've yet to have anybody tell me. I've yet to have anyone document it. Nothing. Because it's not out there. Private health care, sorry, it's more expensive. We're spending over $15,000 per health care plan in this country. We are spending twice as much as the industrialized world, and we've got 50 million people with no health insurance and 100 million underinsured. Explain to me how that's smart. At some point, we got to take back what is the purview of you and me, of we the people, the commons, ours. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Suzanne Mettler. She's the author of The Submerged State, How Invisible Government Policies Undermine American Democracy. Back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. For millions of workers across America, family paychecks have declined or stagnated to such an extent that real median household income was lower in 2010 than it was in 1997, according to Census Bureau numbers. The AFL-CIO says it's time to end the failed economic experiment of lowering taxes on the rich, dismantling regulations on business, and following NAFTA-like global trade policies, because that has only led to an unequal economy that only works for the very richest Americans. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says there's an urgent need for Congress to pass President Obama's American Jobs Act. With a record 46.2 million Americans in poverty, Weingarten says there's a terrible impact on families, kids, and schools. Weingarten says that with families struggling to find jobs and to overcome economic hardship, schools can be a source of stability for families and communities and a place where students and their parents can get the services they need to have a chance at success. The AFT says nearly two-thirds of school staff across the country report they are regularly seeing kids having trouble in school because of hunger. So to end high joblessness and reduce poverty, the AFL-CIO says we need family-sustaining jobs, more investments in our futures, and fair taxation. Who would applaud a mass firing of workers? Jesse Russell lets us know.
When President Ronald Reagan made the decision to fire thousands of air traffic controllers in August of 1981 for continuing a strike, few saw it as a reason to celebrate. Tuesday night, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie gave a speech at Reagan Library and gave his recollection of the 1981 incident. And when he mentioned the mass firing by Reagan, the audience broke out in applause. The cheering comes at a time when the unemployment rate stands at 9% in the United States, and budget cuts by Republicans have resulted in more than 500,000 additional job losses for public sector employees.
With a third time be the charm for R.J. Reynolds tobacco workers seeking union representation, a secret ballot vote will be held at two of the company's North Carolina plants to determine if workers want to be represented by the International Association of Machinists. The vote is expected at the end of October. This newscast made possible in part by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP. Trying to form a plutocracy, but if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world.
Oh, yes, it would be. Yes, it would be. It'd be wonderful to live in a conservative world where everything was privatized, where we didn't have to worry about education or health care. You're just basically on your own. And today, Governor Corporate came out with his privatization team. And in his defense, he said many people may not recognize it, but privatization has been successful in government for many years, from snow removal, he says, to social services. Tom Corbett goes on to say private job creators have been doing the work that government bodies simply could not do without an increased cost to taxpayers and a drop in efficiencies. The governor went on to say, too often debates over privatization fail to recognize this simple fact. It's already working, he says, to the benefit of taxpayers. Yeah, I guess now we're calling lies simple facts. Simple facts for simple tens. That'd be a great bumper sticker. Lies equal simple facts for simple tens. Nuts. So I've asked Suzanne Mettler. She's the author of The Submerged State, How Invisible Government Policies Undermine American Democracy. And I can't think of a better topic to talk about today. Suzanne, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
You know, I look at our governor. He's now got this panel of the who's who of, campaign donors, right-wing insiders, and privatizers going to go through every function of the state government and every asset and try and sell off what they can and privatize what they can. And all in the name of we're going to save taxpayers' money.
Well, it's a lot of smoke and mirrors because so much of what's called part of the market is really subsidized by government and by Americans of all income levels. And yet it's presented as if it's the market at work. And that's what my book is about, on the submerged state.
You know, for years I've been talking about this, that, you know, what appears to be that something that private for-profit corporations are doing is really at the behest of we, the taxpayers. And it's something that quite often we used to do for ourselves and an awful lot cheaper without a profit motive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, it's actually a pretty old tradition in the United States to find ways to create public policies where we channel them through the market, and so it gets very confusing to separate out what's truly public and what's private. My focus is on looking at social benefits, social welfare benefits of all varieties that are directed through either the tax code or through subsidies to private organizations so that they then in turn either lend money or give health benefits or retirement benefits to individuals. And there's a whole lot of that we do. I call it the submerged state. Most Americans receive as many of these kind of benefits through the submerged state as they do more visible direct benefits, right, like unemployment insurance and Social Security and the like. But there's several differences between them. I mean, they both impose a cost and add up to, you know, larger federal deficits. But one of the big differences is that the submerged policies tend to be particularly generous to the most affluent people.
Yeah, we're bailing out the very wealthy. And I think a perfect example of that is, you know, the home interest deductions.
Yes, absolutely. The home mortgage interest deduction. Yeah, in that case, 70% of the benefits go to the wealthiest 15% of households in the United States. They're often defended by political leaders as if they're really a benefit for middle-class people and as if they help Americans to buy their first home. But that's not the case. While a lot of Americans get a little bit from the home mortgage interest deduction, in fact, the lion's share of the benefits go to people who have very expensive homes up to $1 million and who have the highest income.
Yeah, you know, and you pointed out in your book something that I've been talking about for years. You know, I met a woman while I was pumping gas years ago, and she said she was in the middle class because she didn't take any subsidies from the government. And, you know, she made like $16,000 a year, and she claimed she got nothing from the government, so that made her middle class. And it got me thinking then about how unreasonable we can be in our thoughts that we're not getting things from our government. And you go into the fact that most people don't think they get anything from the federal government.
Yes, that's right. Well, I did this survey a while back where I asked people right up front, have you ever used a government social program, yes or no? And then I went on to ask them about, have you used this or that? I went through 21 different federal social policies. And then I looked at how people who'd used these programs, which were very widespread, how they answered the questions. And there was a real disparity. I mean, when I asked the first question about have you ever used a government social program, 57% said they had never done so. But then it turned out that, in fact, 94% of those people who had denied using programs had used at least one at some point, and the average respondent had used four.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it reminds me of during the healthcare debate when the senior citizen said, you know, keep your government hands off my Medicare.
Yes, exactly, exactly. That kind of epitomizes it. And so, I mean, there are many problems with the submerged state besides the fact that it, you know, it does the opposite of what we think social programs do. We think social programs benefit low to middle-income people, but in fact it benefits mostly the wealthiest Americans. In most cases, there are some exceptions, like the earned income tax credit, but in the main it's upwardly redistributive. But besides that, it's fundamentally undemocratic because it can't be seen, and people are barely aware of it even when they themselves receive these policies, and because most people have no idea that these policies tend to benefit the rich particularly. That means that when we have debates in Congress about these policies, the public is checked out. The public is unaware of what's at stake. But interest groups are keenly aware of what's at stake because they benefit tremendously from these policies. The health insurance companies do, the realtors industry, all kinds of industries in our society benefit from the tax subsidies that they get and other varieties of subsidies. So they are armed and ready. They make campaign contributions on a regular basis on both sides of the aisle. They do extensive lobbying. And whenever these policies are threatened, they immediately go to battle, and then members of Congress, often on both sides of the aisle, will defend these policies, and debate is shut down.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many working class people who have high-priced lobbyists. You know, as a union member, I had a lobbyist. He wasn't all that high-priced, but he was still a lobbyist at that, and my voice eventually got to the local congresspeople. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Suzanne Mettler. Her book, The Submerged State, How Invisible Government Policies Undermine American Democracy. We've got a link to how you can get the book over at Powell's Bookstore at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Suzanne Mettler's name. It'll take you right there. You know, I think a perfect example is, you know, one of the things that I complain about quite often is the difference between the taxes I pay on the work that I do, the sweat of my brow, the ache of my back, and someone sitting on a yacht somewhere collecting capital gains. To me, there's a major problem there, and I don't think most people understand it.
Yeah, no, that's right. And these policies are confusing to people because they look like a reduction in taxes when they are at the same time a social benefit. I hear a lot from people who are reading my work who object to that and say, oh, this is just government taking less of my taxes and it's not supposed to take so much from me anyway. But the point is that these policies, they're not for everyone across the board. Policymakers make distinctions and they give them to some people and not others, just as we do when we create all kinds of other direct social programs. So, for example, we have a tax break that's for homeowners but not for renters. So they're selective, and then, you know, some people get a whole lot more out of them than others. So it's not the same as just a reduction in taxes, and it's very costly to our society.
You know, as you said, there's an entrenched interest in keeping this submerged state afloat. How do we fight back to that? How do you change that? Because, you know, you're right. There are big moneyed interests who are fighting to keep these tax breaks. And I go back to the tax reform bill of 86, which we're hearing a lot of people saying, well, we need to do the same thing again now that we did back then, which is lower the rates again and do away with the loopholes. And I say, if we do that, we're going to do the exact same thing that happened then. The very next day, the wealthy will get their loopholes back.
Yes. That's right, exactly. Well, and I want to talk about what we can do to fight back, but first I want to say one more thing about how important it is. The existence of this submerged state makes it extremely difficult to pursue progressive politics. because it leaves people really confused about what government is and what government does. So here we are in a state where, you know, the economy is doing so terribly, the unemployment rate is so high, and yet there is this anti-government spirit that is alive and well, and people are saying cut back government programs. Because of the submerged state, people, so many people are just not even aware of the ways in which they actually do benefit from government. So we can't have a real discussion about it. We can't have a real discussion about taxes or deficits or government spending as long as we have this submerged state. And, you know, with policies that Obama has tried to pursue, it's been very clear that it's been really hard for him to make changes in the submerged state. It's been easy to make expansions in it, in fact. So he has expanded.
Healthcare is the perfect example.
Right, exactly. Healthcare, you know, the individual mandate. In fact, the insurance companies loved it. It brought them a whole lot more customers. But also because of that, most Americans are unaware that this is actually a substantial new policy that may bring them new benefits because it's so hidden and obscured in the submerged state that it makes it really difficult for a reformer to defend these kinds of policies to the general public.
Right. And so, the problem is it's so far down the road that, you know, any real benefit people aren't going to feel for a while. And what we get caught up in, we get caught up in all of the inside baseball stuff, all of the, you know, the give backs to industries. You know, I think about, you know, back during the Bush years, the big pharma bill, where they passed the Medicare Part D. And he had the guy, one of the key votes, Billy Townsend, who then cast his vote and almost the next day took a job with Big Pharma making a multi-million-dollar salary.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And was again a player in healthcare reform this time around and getting things on his terms. But you asked what we can do to fight back against this, and we can. I mean, it's policymakers assume that people cannot understand these policies, and that's wrong. And that plays into the interests of the industries that benefit from them so much. But I have found in my research that if people receive just basic explanations of what these policies are and who benefits from them, that they are able to form opinions about them that reflect their interests and values. And what I found is that when people know more about these policies that mostly benefit wealthy people, that in fact most low to middle income people become really opposed to them, and it really would change the debate if there was more information, if policymakers and organizations like labor unions would inform their members more. Just in, it doesn't really take a lot to do this, so that people would know what's at stake when these policies are being discussed.
Yeah, I think Warren Buffett coming out saying that he pays less tax rate than his secretary, and Russell Simmons came out and said, you know, he's got 100 employees, he pays a lower tax rate than all of his employees, and I think that resonates with people going, what, you're sitting on a yacht somewhere paying collecting dividend checks and you're paying less tax than I am, busting my behind in the hot sun?
Exactly. It's not that complicated to explain that, and it's what I call revealing the submerged state, and I think it can really change the debate, and it can help people to then decide what their views are and to mobilize around them and to make a difference.
Yeah, but here's the thing that I have with that. I mean, we don't see the investor class and the opulence and the extreme wealth in our face anymore. There are no CEOs that live in my neighborhood. Everybody in my neighborhood struggling like I am, and I agree with the Tea Party. Taxed enough already. People in my neighborhood. But it's this weird kind of concept that we won't look to where all the money is and say, it's time for you to give back a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting that there are people like Warren Buffett who are willing to take a lead and say, yeah, we ought to be taxed more.
Well, I think he, you know, out of self-interest as well, because eventually someone's going to come for him. I mean, things will hopefully not get bad enough that I had someone call not too long ago, said, we're going to relive the French Revolution. You know, there's kind of a thought there as well, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, to think that we could continue to have a thriving economy as we had in the past if, 80% of Americans are left behind, it's just not realistic. So, you know, that's, I think, a realization that we've got to come to.
So how much of this submerged state is it that people just don't know what things are being provided by the government? I go back to the Bush handouts when he gave a couple hundred bucks back in a check. I remember he sent out a letter first. It cost the government like $18 million to send out this letter to say, hey, keep an eye on your post box. Your Bush prize is going to be in the mail.
Yes.
Everybody knew that Bush prize was a handout from the government. They knew it came from the government.
Exactly.
It was the most inefficient way of doing it, but they knew.
Yeah, no, he made it very clear. Obama has actually done the opposite, and he got advice from the behavioral economists in his administration. They said, instead of giving out this money in a lump sum, you should dole it out just little by little, a few dollars a week in people's paychecks, because that will make people spend it right away, and that will help stimulate the economy. Now, we still don't know whether it really helped to stimulate the economy by doling it out in that way, but what we do know is that it made it completely hidden from most people's perspective. So in the stimulus bill of 2009, it was 38% of it was in the form of tax cuts, like the making work pay tax cut that Obama had campaigned on. And this went to 95% of working Americans. But 1 year later, there was a survey done, and people were asked, has the Obama administration increased your taxes, lowered them, or have they stayed the same? Only 12% knew that they had been lowered. And everybody else thought they'd either stayed the same or had been increased. A large percentage of people thought they'd been increased. So what it meant was that Obama didn't get any credit for what he'd done. And this is a classic instance of the submerged state, is you can do things that are genuinely progressive, but nobody knows about them. So then they're not sustainable. And people, you know, can't really recognize, well, which political leaders are actually helping me out and which ones are working against me. It makes it very confusing.
Yeah. So for me, I've always said, you know, the Republicans are masters at campaigning, sloganeering, and tooting their own horn. The Democrats, for the most part, are a little better at governing, but not as good as tooting their own horn, and definitely not as good as campaigning or sloganeering.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So what I'm calling for is better communication about this by political leaders and by organizations like unions, and also attention to policy design and delivery. Like, I think that if after people paid their taxes, if they would get then a receipt that showed them exactly how much they got out of each of these different benefits, it would, you know, help make it clearer to people the extent to which government is helping them out.
That's a good idea.
Yeah,
I doubt they'll take it.
I think we could do some fairly simple things like that that would help a great deal.
It comes down to going out there and telling the word, and maybe putting it like the one guy complained. There's a road sign on the road saying this is the Recovery Act money at work, but he now knows that's what it was. Again, the book is The Submerged State by Suzanne Mettler. How Invisible Government Policies Undermine American Democracy. Again, you can get it. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Suzanne's name. It'll take you right there. Suzanne, I appreciate the time. Thanks for the book. Great work.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you, Rick.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
Do you know any of the dozen Congress critters who are on the super powerful Deficit Reduction Super Committee? I don't mean do you know their names, but do you really know them? Know them well enough that they'll take your call? This is one congressional committee that's likely to affect your life, for it's going to decide such things as whether to whack your Social Security benefits or cut back on Big Oil's $4 billion a year taxpayer subsidy. You might have an opinion about which choice the super committee members should make, but can you reach any of the members personally and get a chance to bend their ear? No? Too bad, because Big Oil can, and it is. So are insurance giants, Wall Street bankers, and other corporate powers, not only because of their big-dollar campaign donations, but also because they have some very special lobbyists who are on a first-name basis with the members. You see, these lobbyists used to work for the 12 lawmakers on the Super Committee. About 100 former congressional staffers have now been hired by various corporate interests to lobby their old bosses. General Electric, for example, has 8 lobbyists on board who previously were on the staffs of Super Committee members. They include the head of GE's Washington Lobbying Brigade, who had been the chief of staff for Senator Max Baucus. Indeed, Baucus's Senate office seems to have been a training ground for influence peddlers. A couple of dozen of his former aides are now lobbying him and the other 11 deficit whackers to protect the subsidies that oil, insurance, and other corporations receive from us taxpayers. As one congressional watchdog dryly notes, it's not like the 12 members are in an idealized platonic debating society. This is Jim Hightower saying, indeed not. Once again, the game is rigged for those with the money and the connections to play inside. And they wonder why Congress and corporate lobbyists rank below E. coli bacteria in public approval ratings.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Fascist, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to fight. You fascists, go by.
You know, Suzanne wrote in her book, and again, if you want to pick up a copy of it, go to therickssmithshow.com, and there's a link that'll take you over to Powell's book. You can pick up The Submerged State. She writes, from 1980 until the current recession, the core sectors that it nurtured, this submerged state she's talking about, were finance, insurance, and real estate. They outpaced growth in other sectors of the American economy. The fortunes of these industries emanated not from market forces alone, but rather from their interplay with the hidden policies that promoted their growth and heaped extra benefits on them. You know, finance, real estate, insurance, that's where the big money's at. That's where the big handouts are. And the big lobbyists. And that's why you gotta get money out of the politics. And I know it's almost a pipe dream, and we've talked about it before, but at some point there's gotta be some accountability. Something. And, you know, I look at Warren Buffett and, yeah, you know, he's come out and said, you know what, I pay less taxes than my secretary does. And, oh, everybody thinks, oh, he's a great guy. No, it's in his interest. If we have a crumbling economy, if we have infrastructure that's falling apart, if we have an education system that isn't training workers, he can't make money. He's figured out that the infrastructure that we have, you know, be it whatever it is, the roads, the bridges, the health care, the education system, whatever, that's what made him all the money that he's got. That infrastructure, the police departments, the stock exchange, the courts, all of that. That's what made him the money. And that has to be preserved. So the right wing is in full attack mode. Pat Buchanan said, well, I think he's a bit of a hot dog. And then, you know, kind of say, well, you know, why doesn't he pay her taxes, meaning the secretaries? He says, you know, I really want to pay more taxes, and my secretary pays more than I do. Then why doesn't he pay more taxes, he said. And why doesn't he pay her taxes? And again, it's just kind of a blow-off point to try and change the subject. And the real subject here is the screwed-up nature of our tax code that values investing over work, that values putting your money in stocks than actually swinging a hammer or creating wealth. Russell Simmons came out, wrote an interesting piece about going to Liberty Plaza and going with the people there at Occupy Wall Street. He's saying he's going to bring a couple hundred thousand people with him, which I think would be a great thing. But he says, you know, he said, I'm asking the United States government, raise my taxes and not allow the Republicans to use the economic recession as an opportunity to strip the basic programs that protect our most vulnerable. This is a guy worth $340 million saying, look, raise my taxes. And there are a bunch of these millionaires out there saying, look, you know, we made our money because there was an infrastructure. We made our money because there was an education system that was best in the world. We made our money because, you know what, for a long time, the college graduation rate in this country was number one in the world. We are now 16th and falling. When does it end? And I looked at this New York Times piece this week. Just down the road, Reading, Pennsylvania. Now considered, it's amazing, you know, the city having the largest share of residents living in poverty. Nothing good comes out of that. They edged out Flint, Michigan, and they edged out Camden, New Jersey, and Brownsville, Texas, right here in our listening area, right here in our backyard, the area with the highest level of poverty. Education attainment rates, pathetic. And you stop and you think about it. Employment in the city dropped by 10% from 2000 to 2010. And you look at the education, only about 63% of the residents of the city of Reading graduated from high school. They have high school educations. Nationally, it's 85%. So Reading is 63% of their residents. And now you go down to college and forget it. Just way down the list. You're talking about 5%. 5% of the residents with college degrees. So now you look at these areas and you go, well, you know, low education attainment, high poverty. We know that. So what's the governor here do? Well, we're going to cut education. And when you allow companies to leave and when these big companies up and move overseas and all, because you know what? They got to chase the profit. This is what they live in their weight. Flint, Michigan, for years, one of the most poverty-ridden areas, still is, because General Motors left. Reading's no different. Lucent Technologies, Dana Corporation, gone. China. Is this the kind of world we want to live in? I sure hope not. I sure hope not, because it's scary, scary stuff. Citing the most recent data available, this guy, Timothy Smidling, he is citing the National Survey of Family Growth. He's a professor at University of Wisconsin. He said 62% of young fathers in the United States earn less than $20,000. And we talk about the family unit. And you talk about, women taking care of their children. And in Reading, this article goes through story after story of young women being in the workforce. Because understand, there are more women in the workforce today than there were just 10 years ago. And there are actually more women working than men. And you can thank that on the 90s welfare to work program, pushing people off welfare into crappy jobs. So now you got all these women working and supporting their husbands in low-paying jobs. And we wonder why we have high poverty rates. Why? Because we have no manufacturing base. So you look at the Philly Inquirer yesterday. They reported total employment fell in...
Of workers across America, family paychecks have declined or stagnated to such an extent that real median household income was lower in 2010 than it was in 1997, according to Census Bureau numbers. The AFL-CIO says it's time to end the failed economic experiment of lowering taxes on the rich, dismantling regulations on business, and following NAFTA-like global trade policies, because that has only led to an unequal economy that only works for the very richest Americans. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says there's an urgent need for Congress to pass President Obama's American Jobs Act. With a record 46.2 million Americans in poverty, Weingarten says is a terrible impact on families, kids, and schools. Weingarten says that with families struggling to find jobs and to overcome economic hardships, schools can be a source of stability for families and communities and a place where students and their parents can get the services they need to have a chance at success. The AFT says nearly two-thirds of school staff across the country report they are regularly seeing kids having trouble in school because of hunger. So to end high joblessness and reduce poverty, the AFL-CIO says we need family-sustaining jobs, more investments in our futures, and fair taxation. Who would applaud a mass firing of workers? Jesse Russell lets us know.
When President Ronald Reagan made the decision to fire thousands of air traffic controllers in August of 1981 for continuing a strike, few saw it as a reason to celebrate. Tuesday night, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie gave a speech at Reagan Library and gave his recollection of the 1981 incident. And when he mentioned the mass firing by Reagan, the audience broke out in applause. The cheering comes at a time when the unemployment rate stands at 9% in the United States, and budget cuts by Republicans have resulted in more than 500,000 additional job losses for public sector employees.
With a third time be the charm for R.J. Reynolds tobacco workers seeking union representation, a secret ballot vote will be held at two of the company's North Carolina plants to determine if workers want to be represented by the International Association of Machinists. The vote is expected at the end of October. This newscast made possible in part by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Looking around, the sky is blue. I'm going to make a change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Last Friday, we talked about convicted former Pennsylvania State Judge Michael Conahan and he being sentenced to 210 months in prison for the Cash for Kids scandal that went on. This whole thing of longer sentences for kids to go into these privatized prisons. And I got to be honest, I don't think 210 months is enough for someone like him. But it begs the question. You know, why are we privatizing our prison systems? Who is it benefiting? I was told recently that Pennsylvania has 47 private, for-profit prisons here in the state, and only 17 publicly held facilities. That makes me uneasy. So you got to ask the question, how many other judges are being influenced, like the Cash for Kids guys? And how many politicians, how much money is going into their hands? And I looked at this report from the Michigan Messenger who said that the for-profit corporate-run facilities, their incarceration rates grew by 37%. And their lobbying efforts grew by 165%. So they are filling the campaign coffers. They are filling the pockets of somebody. Ohio's trying to privatize their prisons. Pennsylvania, Governor Corcoran's trying to sell off everything we can do here. And I guess Florida. Florida's prisons are on the auction block as well. But the people are fighting back. And the Teamsters down in Florida recently filed an ethics complaint. I honestly did not know Florida had an ethics commission. But here to talk to us a little bit about it is Ken Wood. Ken is a international vice president with the Teamsters Union. He's also president of the local 79 Teamsters Union down in Tampa, Florida. Ken, thanks for taking time for me.
No problem, Rick. How are you doing this evening?
I'm good. I honestly didn't know that Florida had an ethics commission to start with.
Go ahead.
I guess I didn't. So let's talk about the complaint. Why?
Well, several reasons. First of all, as you said, in the state of Florida, there's been legislation that's been signed by our governor to privatize approximately 20% of the correctional facilities in the state of Florida, which is basically southern Florida. This is being done by going to a privatization, as you're saying. And what's happened at this point, the reason that the lawsuit was filed, was because we feel that there is a conflict of interest, meaning this, two of the leading privatization companies that looks like they're in line for the bid are the very companies who had contributed to the governor's inauguration and some Republicans' campaigns when they was running for their particular office. So obviously we think this is a conflict of interest. We think it ought to be fair, and that's why the complaint was filed.
And where's this going to go from here, do you think?
Well, it's kind of a, at this point, it's been filed. The commission meets on a irregular, well, on a basis, but we got it in just a little bit before the I'm sorry, a little after the deadline. And so what happens is there will be a review to see if the complaint has merit. And if the complaint has merit, then it will be given to a board. They will do the investigation. And then based on their recommendations, on their findings, we'll determine where it would go from there.
I had read somewhere that the two groups had given the Republican Party somewhere around $1 million in inaugural contributions for the big party.
Yes, is that true? That's what I mentioned earlier. It's about $700,000 to $800,000 that we had discovered, and that was some of the basis for our lawsuit. Because once again, we feel, you know, these companies had somewhat of a vested interest and contributing to the inauguration or the campaign, and now they're the ones that are possibly going to be considered for this privatization.
So basically your basic quid pro quo, I'll give you close to $1 million and you sell off your prisons and we'll all be happy together. Let me ask you, how are the Teamsters affected by this? Do you have members that you represent there? How does that play out?
Well, currently the correctional officers are being represented by the PBA. And they came to us a little over a year ago, and they were dissatisfied. They felt they did not have a voice in their contract and legislative issues that should have been addressed at the Capitol, Tallahassee, were not being taken care of. So they were dissatisfied with their current collective bargaining agreement and their representatives, and they came to us. And we're going to be going to a vote. The ballots should be going out somewhere in about the third week of October. They will probably be counted within 30 days after they're mailed out, and then the members will have a voice in determining who they want to represent us, whether it's the Teamsters, PBA, or no union. We don't think the no union is going to get any votes, but, you know, it's going to be between us and our current representatives of PBA.
We'll see how that works out. But, you know, you look at this whole issue, this idea of privatizing what is a function of we the people. I'm sorry, I'm just not seeing the benefit to society. What I then see is we've built this prison industrial complex where it's this whole cesspool, this whole incestuous relationship of lobbying for longer, harsher sentences, putting people in jail for minor things, just so you can make a buck off of it. And we, the taxpayers, we end up getting fleeced.
Well, obviously there's some concerns. All correctional facilities are required to have the safety of the public, the officers that are there, and also the inmates. And there has been a couple that had been privatized, and one in particular is in my jurisdiction up in the Hernando County area. And because of the problems with the privatization, the things not being taken care of as far as the security, they took it back over. Furthermore, in the state of Florida, if you're going to privatize a public sector, that you're supposed to show a 7% savings to the taxpayer. I mean, that would be one of the reasons that you're able to go from public to private sector. At this point, even before they can start the 7% savings, they're going to have to come up with $25 million to pay off the current employees for their accrued unused vacation, sick leave, and comp time. So even before they can show 7%, they got to come up $25 million. And this legislation obviously was pushed in this last session. Obviously, it was rushed through. They had the votes on both sides. They knew the governor was going to do it. As a matter of fact, the individual who the governor had appointed to be the commissioner for the correctional facilities, he has just been removed, and he came in this year with the new governor, and he came in from, I believe it was the state of Indiana. And that was his MO in Indiana, was to privatize. So it was a stage set when the governor came that they was going to privatize. We think it's improper. We think a lot of people are going to lose their jobs. We've got correctional officers that we're being told that they could have been a correctional officer for 15, 20, 25 years, and they're just going to lose their job. They have no idea what's going to happen with the state of the economy, what's going on in the state of Florida, the unemployment. It's just totally unethical, improper to that, do this to these individuals.
And this is
their pension, their health and welfare. So,
you know, when I look at this, this is another, and, you know, I talk to people and you say, well, why do I need to belong to a union? Why do I need a collective bargaining agreement? I think you just laid it out. Someone to stand up for you when things go wrong, like it sounds like they're going down and, with the prison situation down there where these people, 20, 25 year employees could be kicked to the curb, for no other reason than, well, we can get cheaper workers.
Well, I might add this too also about just the things that are happening to working people today. As we know, most union contracts provide for health and welfare. Most time it's paid for by the employer, or it might be a small contribution from the employees. In addition to that, it's a pension. And we all know that when you go to the bargaining table, there's so much is on the table, and the members, you know, they'll want so much for a general wage increase, and obviously they'll put so much into a pension or health and welfare. But that's all decided at the bargaining table of what can be afforded, what can't be afforded, and how that money will go. Florida is probably one of the richest, healthiest pension plans there is as far as public employees. We're hearing the same legislation just from a stroke of a pen. Now the employees are going to have to start paying 3% of their pension. Now, we would understand that if there were some problems in the budget, if there were some issues that had to be addressed as far as that's concerned. But when Florida is one of the richest pensions there are, and it's well above what other ones are, there was no need to do this. And so now what we're finding out, not only are the employees mandated to start paying 3% of their pension, which they never had to before, now their pension is being reduced. So, again, we think if the respective municipalities, whether it's the city, the state, or whatever it is where these people have their pensions with, if they were properly managed and they weren't a misuse of the money, then they wouldn't have to pay it. So these are the things we're fighting in the state of Florida. And I might also add that our fastest-growing membership in the state of Florida is in the public sector.
Yeah, I mean, because people are starting to realize that, look, if I don't have safety in numbers, if I don't have a representative, I don't have somebody to stand up with me, I'm in big trouble. And we're seeing it across the country as people are getting wages taken away and benefits taken back. I mean, it's rampant.
And Rick, you know, the biggest thing is a lot about job security. And when I say job security, we understand that a union doesn't say that an individual can go out there in the work site, just do anything he wants to. We build the rules and the procedures, and we all understand that.
Yep.
But we won't have some type of structure where today it's this way, today it's another way. We won't know exactly what it is. So people that we're organizing, they want a little control of their livelihood, and they're doing this by coming to the Teamsters and being organized so they can have a say. So tomorrow when they go to work, just because the boss didn't like the way they look or park the car, that they can't let them go, but they have an opportunity to challenge that decision if it's an improper decision made by the employer.
Yep. Last question, you know, and getting back to this, this prison situation, because we're seeing this happen across the country as states are looking for ways to fix their budgets with a real short, infusion of cash by basically selling this stuff off. Do you think that this complaint you filed is gonna maybe stop this sale or just prolong it a little bit?
Well, obviously we think it's going to get the attention of some people because there's a lot of things going on about this privatization. And obviously one of the complaints has been filed is what we did with this unethical situation where these two companies are doing it. So we think that and some other things are going on with the state of Florida that I mentioned earlier, that they really can't show a 7% savings by going to privatization. The issues that are being brought forward, as you kind of mentioned, about the safety, and you know, maybe some people are being put in prison to be kept there a little bit longer, not because of the crime they commit, but more to have somebody there so the privatization can have people that get paid to guard somebody that doesn't really need to be there.
Yep.
So we think there's a lot of things coming up all of a sudden that's happening, and we're involved. We're bringing it to the attention. The news agencies are reporting it. It's been some good traction, so we're doing our part here in the state of Florida.
Well, thank goodness you're there, Ken Wood. I appreciate your time. Keep up the fight, brother.
All right. I appreciate the call, and you have a good evening.
Thanks so much. Ken Wood, Teamsters International Vice President and President of Teamsters Local 79 down there in Tampa, Florida. We're going to take a quick break. Your calls after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Do you know any of the dozen Congress critters who are on the super powerful deficit reduction super committee? I don't mean do you know their names, but do you really know them? Know them well enough that they'll take your call? This is one congressional committee that's likely to affect your life, for it's going to decide such things as whether to whack your Social Security benefits or cut back on Big Oil's $4 billion a year taxpayer subsidy. You might have an opinion about which choice the super committee members should make, but can you reach any of the members personally and get a chance to bend their ear? No? Too bad, because Big Oil can, and it is. So are insurance giants, Wall Street bankers, and other corporate powers, not only because of their big-dollar campaign donations, but also because they have some very special lobbyists who are on a first-name basis with the members. You see, these lobbyists used to work for the 12 lawmakers on the Super Committee. About 100 former congressional staffers have now been hired by various corporate interests to lobby their old bosses. General Electric, for example, has 8 lobbyists on board who previously were on the staffs of super committee members. They include the head of GE's Washington Lobbying Brigade, who had been the chief of staff for Senator Max Baucus. Indeed, Baucus's Senate office seems to have been a training ground for influence peddlers. A couple of dozen of his former aides are now lobbying him and the other 11 deficit whackers to protect the subsidies that oil, insurance, and other corporations receive from us taxpayers. As one congressional watchdog dryly notes, it's not like the 12 members are in an idealized platonic debating society. This is Jim Hightower saying, indeed not. Once again, the game is rigged for those with the money and the connections to play inside. And they wonder why Congress and corporate lobbyists rank below E. coli bacteria in public approval ratings.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
So yesterday we talked about the listeria outbreak because of the contaminated cantaloupes from Colorado. And now I see that the Speaker of the House, Republican John Boehner, in his district, according to WCPO, they're reporting that 4 kids have become ill after eating the meat with the family in Butler County, Ohio. Sometime back the second week of September. Now, this Tyson Fresh Meats, they recalled 65 tons of ground beef that is believed to be potentially contaminated with E. coli. So now you've got, not only do you got the cantaloupes, but you've got the meat. The station reported that this 8-year-old kid was hospitalized for about 10 days with what they said was severe diarrhea. I don't know. I don't want to be going to the hospital. Man, not for that. But 10 days. So you see these two minor outbreaks. I mean, I think there are 18 people who were killed because of the cantaloupe. And you go, well, it's not minor. 18 people are dead. What you've got is you've got Republicans who are working, doing what they can as we speak to cut and gut inspections, to cut and gut oversight, because, you know, corporations will please themselves. And I know. Tyson voluntarily recalled the 65 tons. Voluntarily. Yeah. They did it because they didn't want a lawsuit. No, they did it because they don't want to have the government say, we're going to now watch over you. And all we keep seeing is what the Republicans want, more cut, and punish. And no oversight. So would you be happy eating contaminated cantaloupe or meat that's going to make you 10 days in the hospital with severe diarrhea? No, thank you. And talking about Florida, and we talked about the prison situation there. And you knew Scott was going to do it because he's in the same mold of Corbett. He's in the same mold of Kasich, the same mold of Walker. They're all kind of Snyder. They're all the same. This sell off all that is ours, sell off everything that the public holds as a profit, as an asset to for-profit people so they can make big money off of it. He was being interviewed on CNBC. And, he was touting, I've cut the budget and I've balanced the budget and I have a surplus and we did all these things. And they asked him, well, gee, how'd you do it? And he was quite proud of the fact that, working for a corporation, we got rid of people. We don't care about those people. We don't care about those workers. We just cut them off. That's how we saved our budget. And you look at what's happened in this country so far. This year, we've lost somewhere around 600,000 public sector jobs nationwide. And you wonder why the unemployment rate isn't going down, because we keep shedding, every time we're adding public sector jobs, they're canning public sector jobs. I mean, every time we add private sector jobs, we're canning public sector jobs. So we're actually losing. So more that is ours is being handed over. And this commission that the governor's got set up worries me on a number of levels, because what assets are we going to lose, Jake? The turnpike, is that going to go? The wine and spirit shops, are that going to go? All of that. Bridges, is that next?
Well, here's the thing. Right now, there's no political leverage to stop it. You got guys like Matt Priate who works, who actually is an employee of an organization, and this is their wet dream. Are you kidding me? I mean, on what basis did he appoint him? Is he saying that he's going to be a fair arbiter? No, he's going to go in there and he's salivating. This is his golden opportunity to fulfill the object of the big time donors to his organization. Are you kidding me? Wow. And then I see a poll today where the governor's ratings, Rick, have gone up. Are you kidding me? You wonder where the heads of the public are.
You got to give the governor credit. You got to give him credit. He has stayed out of the debates. He's pulled back. Let everything else happen in front of him. And when you had the storms come through, he did come out and looked like he was doing a little leadership thing. Did some glad handing. Did some handshaking. All that stuff. So people look at, oh, he's doing his job. Let's give him a pat on the back. I mean, smart. You may not think he's the brightest bulb in the box, but compare him to Walker and Kasich, politically, he's doing the right thing.
Well, you talked about Marcella Shale and his lack of commitment, to put a tax on the drilling. That there's been bits and pieces coming out that, the governor is thinking of maybe doing it and taking some of that extra money and shoring up education. I mean, you called that. You called that a month ago, and those are the kind of things, when you think about it, that have kept his ratings up. But as far as what he's done to workers and what he's done to the union movement and what he's done to some constitutional rights, it's frightening.
And talking about Florida, this guy was on Rachel Maddow. Carl Hassan is his name. He's a columnist down for the Miami Herald. And I love this guy. I think now I have a favorite columnist now. He was on Rachel Maddow, and he said, talking about the governor's plan to drug test every welfare recipient. Since we're talking about Florida, he said, interestingly, the governor's pee in a cup mandate doesn't apply to the one bunch that whizzes away more tax dollars than anyone else. He said the legislators who pass such useless laws. He said, I say line up all 160 of them for a patriotic whiz fest at the Capitol Clinic. He says, you think more than 2.5% of them might test positive? He said, let's find out. He said, I'll pay for it out of my own pocket. Seriously. And you know what? I'd help him pay for that.
That would be extremely interesting.
It would be. Because, someone sent me that email that I talked about the other night. Oh, this is a great idea. We're going to test all those drug addict welfare people. 2%. 2% of the people tested positive.
Which is a lower percentage than the general public.
Absolutely. And I went through those statistics and the other night. And what's interesting to me, I sent back the person whose email, I said, well, why don't we have everybody who sent this email, why don't we have every one of those people take a drug test? And I'll guarantee more than 2% of them will fail.
What is it about the public that they just love, you know, when somebody's down, they just love to push their face in the mud? What is it about us?
You know, I had a friend who, he used to collect people's complaints. If things were down, he was the guy who would sit and listen to you complain and carry on and, you know, the whole nine yards. How miserable your life was, he would sit and happily listen. And one time I asked him, I said, you know, why do you absorb all this? And he goes, quite honestly, it makes me feel better about myself. My problems aren't as bad as theirs. And there's something to that. When you look at this, you know, we want to pick on the people behind us. We're better than those people. And I think that's something in our psyche. I think it's something in our minds that, which is kind of weird in a so-called Christian country, that we would think that way, but, you know, somehow we do. And I remember as a kid, they say we want the churches to take care of things, and we want the churches to run the food bank, and we want the churches to do all this. And I remember as a kid, there was never any help from our church, and I lived in an absolute hellhole. The projects there by the airport on the west side of Cleveland, we're next to the airport. Imagine how bad that is. And the churches, the church people who, if they did something, it was always looking down at through the tip of their nose at you. Like somehow they were superior to you and that you needed them. And it was really a very disturbing experience. And it's one of those things that I try never to do to anyone else when I help others. I try to do more things anonymously than I do where, hey, look at me. Because I think that's the way it's supposed to do. That's the way it's supposed to be. Which is why I'm a firm believer in having government programs that help people. You know, one person cannot, walking up and down the street here in Harrisburg with all the homeless folks here, one person cannot change that. All of us collectively throwing in, we have the ability to end that. The question is, do we have the political will? And in this environment, I say no. We've been sold 30 years of me, 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 me. I mean, hyper me. I mean, we've always been a me society. I mean, human beings have always been about me. But it's been the last 30 years where it's really super hyper. We've kicked it into high gear where it's hooray for me and the heck with everybody else. And I think a lot of it has to do is we don't live next to people anymore. I don't even know our neighbors for crying out loud.
Well, and then you have the media. I mean, I just saw a show the other night. Your buddy Ed, I know you're not a big fan of him, but he had two commentators on. One was a liberal, one was a conservative. You know, that's basically what it is. And the radio talk show host, a woman from Las Vegas, believe it or not. And the question was asked, should the rich be paying their fair share? She didn't answer. You know what she said? Those poor people. They don't pay anything. They should be paying more. They should be paying the same percentage as me. And I listened to her, and my jaw dropped. And she was serious. That is the kind of
mentality.
That's
the right-wing frame.
That is the kind of mentality that has been sold upon this country. And a lot of people who are working class have bought into it, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, it's such a vague term, though. I mean, to be honest, what is their fair share? How much is the fair share? That's kind of one of those things that kind of sticks with me. What their share should be is what it takes to educate the children of this country. What their share should be is what it takes to help their business by having infrastructure and broadband access and public transportation and all of those things because they have the money. I mean, I look at the six Walmarts. Six Walmarts have almost $100 billion. That's more than,
she did ask, give me a figure, and Ed said, okay, let's take it to the Clinton, the numbers during the Clinton administration, was it 39%?
39%, never going to happen.
You can strive for it, at least raise at least raise them a little bit.
The Republicans will shut this country down and let it go straight down the toilet before they allow it to go up to 39%. Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. When we come back, we're talking with Edward Payne. He's an unemployed worker down in the Philly area. He's also the leader of Fight for Philly. We're back after this.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Fillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated, professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Gas like grocery data hazes. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickspithshow.com. So it looks like Edward Payne's not gonna be here. We're still trying to get a hold of him, so we're going to move along. But this afternoon they had rallies across the state at Senator Toomey's offices saying, hey, man, where are the jobs? You ran on a jobs platform, but everything that you seem to be doing is the direct opposite of what's going to create jobs. The more you push policies that are going to destroy the jobs that we have, the harder it's going to be. And, you know, he had a good number of people across the state getting out to his office, and that's what's going to have to happen more and more. People are going to, and I've been calling for this since the beginning of this recession. People are going to have to get to the streets, boots on the ground, voices loud. This is how it has to happen. Because while they're sitting in their ivory towers, they really don't care about you or me. Not at all. Anyway, so yesterday we talked about the Obama administration asking the Supreme Court to look at the health care mandate, to look at the health care bill. Hopefully they will come up with some type of decision soon. Again, you know, you look at the fact that retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens said that, you know what, it would pass the muster. That the Affordable Care Act would most certainly clear the constitutional muster under one of the things that he had written just a couple of years ago, this Gonzalez versus Reich. And, you know, at the end of it, this is one of those times where it would sure be nice to have a rational Supreme Court. I'm kind of concerned by the conservative nature. But at the end of this, with the Affordable Care Act, what it's supposed to do is it's supposed to get the states who are supposed to be setting up this plan. Vermont came up with a single-payer, universal, statewide system. Here in Pennsylvania, not so much. In fact, we haven't done anything, to be honest with you. They're gutting programs. I mean, if you remember, Governor Corbett killed the adult basic insurance program, and he said, oh, you know, we're gonna make sure those folks who we kicked off the program, we're going to make sure that they get other insurance. We're going to make sure that, you know, there's something there for them. Well, you know, the Philly Inquirer had a piece this week that says, here we are 6 months after Pennsylvania terminated adult basic, which is the state-funded plan for low-income adults. Many of the nearly 41,000 former enrollees who lost their coverage, they're likely uninsured right now. They went on to point out that the few who were able to find a policy, they're paying significantly more. And these new expensive plans have fewer benefits, including 4 doctor visits a year. And, you know, I wonder what happened. I wonder what happened to the Republican Party, because, you know, they used to believe in personal responsibility. They used to believe in their mandates. In fact, I remember, you know, the whole thing. In fact, Mitt Romney himself today said, I guess he's not going to say anything. These clips just aren't working. But he said, look, this used to be the party of personal responsibility. We used to be the party that believed in that. That you paid your own bills, you made your own way. Not anymore.
And of course, the idea for a health care plan was not mine alone. The Heritage Foundation, a great conservative think tank, helped on that. I'm told that Newt Gingrich was the one of the very first people who came up with the idea of the individual mandate. Did that years and years ago. It was seen as a conservative idea to say, you know what? People have responsibility for caring for themselves if they can. Well, you know, we'll help people who can't care for themselves, but if you can care for yourself, you got to take care of yourself and pay your own bills.
Yeah, that's what the Republican Party used to believe. Now, because we got a plan and it's Obama's plan, they're absolutely against it. Anyway, I guess we got Edward Payne on the line. He's one of the folks who participated in the jobs rallies at Toomey's offices around the state. Edward, thanks for taking time for me.
Tom, how are you?
I'm good. Tell me what happened today at the rally.
At the rally, we were just passing out flyers and advocating for Pat Toomey to vote yay on the package that President Obama is going to present to a Congress within the next month or so, I believe. The jobs bill.
The affordable, the American Jobs Act, right?
Yes, the American Jobs Act, yes.
So let's talk about you. How long have you been unemployed?
I've been unemployed about a year and 9 months.
What happened?
I lost my other job, and I attempted to move on. I went to school to become a farm tech. I went to Lincoln Tech for about, I think it was 7 months, and nothing's happened yet. Like, all the hospitals, they have hire freezes, CVS, all the retail chains, they seem to have hire freezes, too.
So there's just nothing. There's just nothing out there. How often are you sending out resumes?
Excuse me, I didn't hear that.
How often are you sending out resumes? How often are you trying to reach out to find employment? Because we hear this frame all the time. The frame is that the folks who've been long-term unemployed, they're just lazy. They don't want to work. Their job's out there, but they're not looking for them. So you know, one of the questions I ask folks is, you know,
I had a job all this time to send out resumes every week. I mean, I haven't stopped sending out resumes. I haven't stopped filling out online job applications. I do several every week.
Yeah, because there's this frame out there, and every person I talk to tells me the same thing. Look, I'm busting my behind. The reality is, man, there aren't any jobs out there, which is why we need a jobs plan.
Yeah, right away.
And this plan that the president has come out with, while not perfect, has a lot of flaws in it, It will help, and it is a start to getting down that road, to getting this economy turned around, so folks like you will have the opportunity to get back to work and support yourself.
Yes, that's important, yeah.
So tell me about the group Fight for Philly. I guess you're one of the while you're unemployed, one of the guys who are trying to get this off the ground to try and get people back to work.
Yes. We do everything. Not everything. We try to get as many people in the West Philadelphia community involved as possible. It's happening slowly. It's not happening as fast as we would like, but we're slowly getting people the access to job training that they need, daycare, and so on and so forth. So it starts there. So when they get, when they finally find work, they won't have to risk their jobs because of other issues.
You know, I look at this and this whole scenario, and I remember when the economy collapsed back in September of 2008. I remember going, you know, this is going to be a nightmare for working people, because the people who caused this, we're going to take care of them first, which is what we've done, and they're going to walk away scot-free, and it's going to be people like you, people like me, who are going to end up being holding the bag.
That's how it always seems to be. It's just a sad reality.
So how do we hold these folks accountable? I mean, I think it starts with education, but it also starts with doing what you did today, getting out in the streets and getting the message out.
Yeah, one other aspect of it is we have to get politicians to vote to end loopholes, so big corporations like Comcast have to pay state taxes. I mean,
that would be nice.
I saw somewhere where I think it was 33% of large corporations paid zero taxes in 2007 or 2008. I mean, I had no idea it was that bad.
Well, it's more like 70% pay no taxes.
I had no idea it was that bad.
Well, because we have this thing, this wonderful thing called the Delaware loophole, where a large corporation can open a P.O. box up in Delaware, and they can funnel all their profits through that magical P.O. box. Because as soon as it goes into that P.O. box, there's magic that happens in that box. And that magic is all of the tax revenue that the people of Pennsylvania used to get is now gone. Magic.
And they wonder why they don't have any money for education or anything else.
And we wonder why we can't get job training programs and get people back to work doing the things that absolutely need to be done. Last question I've got for you. Moving forward, what do you want the politicians, what do you want the state legislature to know? What do we tell the president? How do we get this thing turned around?
Well, we can start in Pennsylvania by having the loophole thing turned around. What is it called? The Delaware loophole?
Right.
We can start by getting that turned around. And also, we could focus on getting packages that will actually create jobs, or employers in our community can be given incentives to hire people that have been unemployed for within a year or a year and a half or so on, stuff like that.
Or you can say, you know what, there's a lot of work that needs to be done down in Center City, Philadelphia. A lot of senior citizens need help around their house. They need the house painted. They need things moved. Maybe we could have a public works program that gets folks back to work, gets them, back to getting up every day with a purpose and earning a paycheck. And that's a good idea, I think.
That's an excellent idea. That's an excellent idea.
Edward Payne, I appreciate the time. I hope you, I hope you find work very soon. I know how tough it is being unemployed. Man.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Crown King, nothing. Smith.
Old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got our rates so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer is a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Yeah, you gotta love the tea twizzlers. You gotta love the nonsense. Really, you do. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. The Independence Hall Tea Party Group. They're down near Philly. These are some kind of whacked out people. Trust me. Some of the stories that I've read today went and they boycotted the Freedom Works seminar. Now, Freedom Works is the people who basically funded the whole Tea Party movement. So now what's going on with this Independence Hall Tea Party is they're even more radical than the Tea Party. They've gone way off the deep end. They are completely off the path. So they're basically boycotting their own. And the whole reason that they're boycotting it is that Freedom Works, they claim, is engaging in a Stop Romney campaign that could ultimately lead to a Barack Obama victory. Look, Freedom Works doesn't want Romney. They don't think he's in line with their insane views, so they're going to push that way. So the Independence Hall Tea Party, they think Romney's okay. And I love the rationale. Now, remember, and this is is this how you see this, Jake? The idea here is that the Tea Party doesn't endorse people. They're not a group that endorses candidates, any of this stuff. But here, what they're saying, and I guess I should just read the quote. He goes on to say that we believe Republican primary voters, Tea Party voters, regular Republicans alike pay close attention to the elections, blah, blah, blah. He goes, if people choose Herman Cain, then he'll be our man. If they choose Michelle Bachmann, then she'll be our woman. If they choose Mitt Romney, then he'll be the one, the leader of the Tea Party said. Basically telling me that they're going to walk lockstep with whatever the Republican Party wants. So now we do know. They're shills. Pretty much right there are shills. And, the more you look at this, the more you realize it is what it is. Just a bunch of people, angry, ticked off, but at the end of the day, shills for the Republican Party. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Andy on line one. How you doing tonight, Andy? I guess you hung up.
How are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
That's good. Hey, we have a Occupy Wall Street group here in San Francisco.
Outstanding.
Yeah, and we got out in front of a bunch of banks today.
Excellent. How'd that work out?
Oh, it was a great demonstration. Had a lot of union people there, particularly SEIU and UAW was represented. And they got out there about 3:30, 4 o'clock in front of one of the main banks in the financial district, a J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, and a lot of Guy Fawkes hats, masks on, and it must have been about 150, 200 people, a lot of signs, bands, music, and everybody just got in front of the windows of the bank. They probably were about a dozen deep in front of the windows of the bank and took up the whole sidewalk all around the bank. It was great.
Well, it's important that folks, and what did you do with that? I mean, it's important to be out there, but we've also got to be educating people of why you're out there and saying, look, you know, at the end of the day, we need to hold these big banks accountable. We need to hold Wall Street accountable. There's a lot of stuff that needs to be done.
Oh, absolutely. The main thing is, I think the main tone is we're the 99% and we're not going to get rolled by the top 1%. And that the banks have, I have a sticker that they gave me there, and it's, you know, make the banks pay.
Absolutely.
The banks have got to start paying their fair share. You know, you were talking about taxes just before. You know, the corporations aren't paying their fair share, and neither are the rich. So well, that's the main thing. It's a lot of tax the rich.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. What's the plan going forward from here? I mean, you had the rally today. Is there something planned for tomorrow?
Well, I think the great thing is about this is that it keeps it ongoing. Now, the cops are being pretty tough, you know, just like in New York, the cops are being pretty tough here, and they're not allowing, a lot of these kids are staying out overnight, and they're trying to camp out, but they keep getting moved, and the cops don't give them very much land or real estate to actually camp out at. So it's been tough for them to do that. But the major thing is, it's great that this is ongoing. When people have the time, when they get off of work, or on the weekend, and you can have a larger demonstration, and you can actually pinpoint something, they can get the people together to do it.
Yep.
And it's like an ongoing thing where it's constantly making people aware that we're not backing down. We're going to continue with this. And I think it's the same thing on Wall Street. We're going to continue occupying that real estate. We're going to continue this, you know, every day. When people have time, more people keep coming. It's not just the same group, it's more people keep on coming and going when they have time to participate, but there is a core group. I think that's the good thing about it. And they are having, just like in New York, general assemblies, and they're having different meetings and different kind of seminars that they're holding when people have time. They do have a website, and they're trying to get the word out on the website when different events are going on.
Yeah, going back to the days of the teach-ins and the sit-ins, and I'm all in favor of that. I think this is how we have, this is how we have to begin organizing again. Face-to-face, talking to people. You know, I like the Twitter, I like Facebook, I like all that stuff, but at the end of the day, it's still gonna be, you know, someone looking somebody in the eye and talking to them. That's how I see this moving.
Oh, it's so important to get in people's faces and to be there right on the ground. And neat thing, too, is there's I heard there's a woman from Spain that's participated in some of the Spanish demonstrations, and they're trying to, you know, give some of the knowledge that they have there. There's supposed to be somebody from Israel here that that was in the Israeli demonstrations that are ongoing, and even somebody from Tahrir Square. There's supposedly an Egyptian fellow here in town that is giving seminars. So they're trying to give that knowledge into what they did at these places, even here in San Francisco. And I think that, again, is really neat in what has to be done.
So we're seeing this kind of stuff popping up all across the country. I know, I think in L.A. they had one, so you're telling me San Francisco. I guess in Chicago, they're talking about one in Philadelphia. So we're starting to see across the country organizations popping up
Absolutely.
To say enough already.
Yeah, this has got to be so pervasive and so ubiquitous all over the country that the corporate media can't but not, you know, put this on the news in small town America and the middle-sized American cities. That's the way it has to be.
Absolutely. Keep up the great work out there, and keep up the fight, and let us know what happens tomorrow and the day after, and let us know what's going on.
Yeah, it was a good one today. Oh, one other thing. You guys have been talking about taxes, and you're talking about the rich.
Yep.
You know, something you have to understand, too. Warren Buffett is not an isolated situation with his 17% tax rate. Forbes, in January 2009, had an article that in 1995, the top 400 families' effective tax rate was only 30%. That's in 1995. In 2006, it was 17%.
Yep.
That's the top 400 families. It's not isolated. It's not idiosyncratic just to Warren Buffett. And Forbes is not a commie pinko magazine. And the AP in April 17, 2011 came out with a report that said, again, the top 400 families, their average tax rate is 17% in 2007 compared to 26% in 1992. This was the Associated Press. Again, not a commie pinko wire service. And also, 2 weeks ago on September 20th in the Financial Times showed that the top 1% by the OECD in the United States, top 1% of taxpayers in 1985 were paying at a 33% rate, and then in 2010 they're paying at a 23% rate. So the top 1% would be much more than just the top 400 families, but still they're only paying at a 23% tax rate. That's lower than most average working people, for God's sake, or you know, probably the middle income, mid to higher middle income people. So still, the rich people are not. They are not across the board. It's not just Warren Buffett. It's across the board. The rich people are not paying their fair share. And I can go on and on about corporations.
Well, absolutely. And at the end of this, it's going to come to, and we're already hearing the voices. We need another tax reform bill of 1986. I heard Alice Rifkin talking about it the other day. Well, you know, we can lower rates and we'll just close off those loopholes like we did back then so that the day after we do it, they can have their lobbyists go back and make sure that they get taken care of. And the one thing about the tax reform bill of 86 that people don't remember, they began taxing unemployment benefits. You want to talk about a slap in the face? They also took away any middle-class loopholes, those little ones that were there. Like if you had interest for credit cards or car loans, you could deduct that interest.
Like took that stuff away. The biggest thing was the doubling in the payroll tax.
Well, the Social Security.
2%, right, the Social Security payroll tax doubled on people making under the, 106, 800.
I think it was like 80-something thousand back then, and
it was much lower then. It's been moving up ever since then.
Andy, I appreciate the call, brother. Keep up the great work, and like I said, let us know what's going on.
Great. Thanks, Rick. We got to keep the pressure on. Take care.
Thank you. Call anytime. You know, I'm looking at this, and I go back to that tax reform bill of 86, and you want to talk about the biggest slap in the face? Ask every one of these unemployed folks when they get that check, and there's that piece taken out for taxes. What a slap in the face, and especially during the Reagan years, him with the high dollar policy. Just nuts. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Camille Rivera from United New York. Back after this.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. For millions of workers across America, family paychecks have declined or stagnated to such an extent that real median household income was lower in 2010 than it was in 1997, according to Census Bureau numbers. The AFL-CIO says it's time to end the failed economic experiment of lowering taxes on the rich, dismantling regulations on business, and following NAFTA-like global trade policies, because that has only led to an unequal economy that only works for the very richest Americans. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says there's an urgent need for Congress to pass President Obama's American Jobs Act, With a record 46.2 million Americans in poverty, Weingarten says, is the terrible impact on families, kids, and schools. Weingarten says that with families struggling to find jobs and to overcome economic hardship, schools can be a source of stability for families and communities and a place where students and their parents can get the services they need to have a chance at success. The AFT says nearly two-thirds of school staff across the country report they are regularly seeing kids having trouble in school because of hunger. So to end high joblessness and reduce poverty, the AFL-CIO says we need family-sustaining jobs, more investments in our futures, and fair taxation. Who would applaud a mass firing of workers? Jesse Russell lets us know.
When President Ronald Reagan made the decision to fire thousands of air traffic controllers in August of 1981 for continuing a strike, few saw it as a reason to celebrate. Tuesday night, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie gave a speech at Reagan Library and gave his recollection of the 1981 incident. And when he mentioned the mass firing by Reagan, the audience broke out in applause. The cheering comes at a time when the unemployment rate stands at 9% in the United States, and budget cuts by Republicans have resulted in more than 500,000 additional job losses for public sector employees.
Will a third time be the charm for R.J. Reynolds tobacco workers seeking union representation? A secret ballot vote will be held at two of the company's North Carolina plants to determine if workers want to be represented by the International Association of Machinists. The vote is expected at the end of October. This newscast made possible in part by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising, a one-hour radio documentary produced by Workers Independent News in conjunction with WORT. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, you can download our podcast there, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and take your program on the go. You know, in talking with Andy in San Francisco, they've got the Occupy San Francisco going on. We saw Kentucky. They've picked up on what's going on in New York, and I understand other groups are joining as we speak. TWU Local 100 jumped into this. This is starting to grow into something I think is going to be pretty powerful. So I've asked Camille Rivera, she's the executive director of United New York, to come talk to us about what's going on there. Camille, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me, what is United New York?
United New York is an organization that is a partnership of organizations, community organizations, and labor organizations whose main priority is to organize low-wage workers around the fight for good jobs, as well as, you know, holding big banks and millionaires accountable for the economic crisis.
So this kind of fits right in with what's starting to happen. I mean, we're starting to hear some ideas coming out of the group there in New York, and some ideas across the country, and it's really starting to turn into a conversation of what kind of an economy do we really want to have in this country.
I think that's exactly right, and I think that many people have been shut out of that conversation, right? Especially, you know, the members or the people that are a part of the United New York Coalition. These are low-wage workers, people that really weren't responsible for the economy but are suffering from it. Labor organizations who have to go back and renegotiate their contracts because, you know, big banks and corporations, failed them and failed the country. And so I think that what the Occupy Wall Street protesters have done is captured that. And I think in the beginning, what you saw was, these are just protesters. Everyone is going out there. Everyone's angry. But they have made such a statement that fits to what we're trying to do, that we felt like we needed to support them and be in solidarity with them.
And now is the time because I've been expecting people, I've been hoping and I've been calling for unemployed and underemployed folks to take to the streets and, like has happened in the past. where people are dissatisfied, they go to their capitals, they go to their elected officials, and they have their voices heard. Sadly, what's going on, especially here in Pennsylvania, I'm not sure how it is in New York, but like unemployment offices don't exist anymore. We do everything over the computer, by phone, so you never see the lines of unemployed. Same thing with welfare and other assistance programs. So you never see the large groups of people, and it's harder to organize. Now I'm starting to see some of the people coming out of the woodworks.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely the point, and I totally agree with you. I mean, we have unemployment centers that are not even in the community. So, for example, someone in Southeast Queens in New York has to go and take, you know, two buses and a train to go to an area that's very kind of outside of the community to go file for unemployment. They usually do it on the phone. And our, you know, what United New York did was we basically canvassed and knocked on thousands of doors and found where these people were. And allowed them to have a voice and basically got them involved. And what you're seeing right now is that when you started the Occupy Wall Street, when you went down there, it was pretty much, you know, it didn't necessarily represent all of New York. And what you're seeing is young people from the city universities, from the state universities, kids from Washington Heights, kids from all across the city. You're seeing unemployed people. You're seeing, you know, labor organizations, labor members going out there and really really kind of finding their voice. And that's why, you know, we really need to support these people on the ground.
Absolutely. And I look at the younger generation right now, kids coming out of college, with, you know, huge amounts of debt on their back and no job to go to, no way to pay that debt back, but you bet you're behind, they're going to be stuck having to pay it back.
Exactly. And they're so scared. I mean, we have a group of about 45, students that work with us, on a regular basis around the economy. And all of them have a story to tell. I have, you know, thousands of dollars in loans. I cannot find a job. I've been unemployed for 2 years. I wanted to go to law school. I can't. I mean, this is what we're doing to our future. This is what we're doing to our kids. And I think that, you know, it's about time that it's not just a responsibility. Fine, you know, you're responsible, but it's also about taking the responsibility to get us out of that problem.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what the message that these protesters are trying to convey.
And good for them. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Camille Rivera. She's the executive director of United New York. I remember back in May there was a pretty big rally going. Some 10,000 people took to the streets marching against Wall Street. Kind of like the beginning of this, I think. And I guess out of that came this Beyond May 12th coalition. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the May 12th coalition came about through a number of different organizations, such as, New York City Communities for Change and other labor organizations, Strong Economy for All, that basically felt, and young people, obviously, and utilizing social media, basically said that they needed to take action. And they used, it was very quick. They used social media in a real big way, about 6 weeks, to organize in Wall Street and do actions, you know, not just around May 12th, but the days before May 12th and the days after May 12th. And it really was amazing. And it was really amazing to see. And what you saw was a kind of a media blackout. You know, you knew it was happening as Facebook was picking it up and Twitter was picking it up, and it did get hit, but it was really a real media blackout around it. And I think that the success of May 12th was that, you know, these kids in Wall Street actually are taking it to another level. They didn't just organize an event for a day and a week. They said, well, you know what, we're going to continue until you start listening to us. And as you saw in the protesters that are down there now, there was a media blackout for a while. People were not covering them. And it wasn't until you started to see, you know, kids getting, you know, beat up and the police, you know, in some ways
pepper
acting,
spraying.
you know, inappropriately and being abusive to these people. When you started to see people taking up their cause, you know, celebrities going down there, when you started seeing that's when you started to see papers, you know, coming out and, you know, media coming out there and saying, hey, wait a minute, something is happening. And it's the consistency that's really making it bigger and bigger. Plus, they have no agenda, right? Their agenda is really just about, we have demands around, you know, banks taking the responsibility and forcing them to make the economy better. And I think that is a simple message that people understand. It's not wonky. It's not policy driven. It's like, you guys messed up. Help us get out of this. Help me find a job. Help my future. Help my kids. Help my country, right?
Yep. Well, what's interesting, and you know, I had a conversation recently with a friend who's a little bit older than me, and probably a lot older than you. And he said, you know, back during the Vietnam War, what scared the establishment to death was the young generation taking to the streets. And what he said back during Vietnam, when they instituted the lottery for the draft, instead of having these exemptions, there was actually a lottery, so everybody's butt was on the line. Young people really took to that, and that's when things turned around. And I look at this economy, now that the younger generation is waking up to the reality that, you know what, in 2-3 years, this isn't going to be any better unless we take to the streets and unless we fight to change things. And I think it's scaring the hell out of the establishment.
No, I think you're right. I mean, look at a lot of these kids go to private universities. They go to, you know, city and public universities. They have loans. They're scared. It's not just I'm just angry, you know, and people say, well, you know, we're not going to be able to awake the youth. We're not going to be able to, you know, they awoke themselves. They said, wait a minute, this is totally unfair. I don't deserve this. And they're taking it, you know, they're taking it to the streets. They're taking it to, and they're not, you know, doing the lobbying. They're not going to Congress. They're saying, no, we're going to take an action here. And you're going to listen to us whether you like it or not. And that's scary to people. It really is. And I think that they have something here. And you know, now, you know, I didn't even know that this was kind of resonating across the country, that different states were starting to have Occupy kind of support, solidarity action. So it definitely is just taking a hold of people in a real way.
Well, I think people are looking for something to get involved, and they're looking for something to grab onto and say, because I understand, you know, when the Tea Party people came out and they were, you know, doing their thing, saying that they're angry and ticked off, I said, yeah, me too. I'm angry and ticked off. Yes, I'm taxed enough already. I'm with you. Then they took this bizarre 10th Amendment anti-government position, and then they kind of lost me. So now this is saying, you know, how do we create an economy that works for all of us, that, you know, we all have an opportunity. So let's talk about, I guess, next Wednesday you're having another rally with another march with the folks from the Beyond May 12th coalition. Back last May, you had some 10,000 people marching. What do you think the turnout's going to be on Wednesday?
I mean, I honestly don't know. It's very quick. We're working hard to try to generate the amount of support that we've got from May 12th. I think that, you know, it depends. You know, labor organizations are doing their own actions as well, you know, and I think there's another event on October 12th that other unions are doing. So I don't necessarily think there's going to be a lot, you know, it's a roaming a round of support, but I think October 5th will generate a lot of, not just, you know, not just kind of the May 12th coalition, but regular people. I really think that people are going to get up and they're going to go. Like, they're going to get off of work, or they're going to take their lunch or whatever, and they're just going to go. And I think that young students, so that you know, the October 5th date was supposed to be a walkout for the state universities and the city universities to protest education cuts and increases in their state tuition. And so these young people just basically said, you know what, we're not even going to do that. This is the message that we want to do. We want to support these workers, these protesters. So let's go out there and do this, you know, support the Occupy Wall Street. So this is kind of really generating organically. And I really think that we're going to see, you know, thousands of people on the street.
Well, that's the hope anyway, because, you know,
that's the hope.
I think the more boots you get on the ground, the more people you get on the ground, the less likely it's going to be that you're going to see the kind of tactics that we saw over the weekend with, you know, the pepper spray and the beatings.
Right.
And the key to this is that this can't be violent. This has got to be the heavy hands of the authorities beating down on the people. It can't be the other way around, or it will lose all credibility, I think.
No, I think that's totally right. It has to be the people that need to be there, right? The people who are really affected, the unemployed, retirees who are worried about their Social Security and Medicare, you know, young people, you know, people of color. Like, we need people out there. Really, you know, really out there being supportive. And I think that, you know, I mean, did you see the air pilots at Wall Street?
I did,
today,
yes.
I mean, that was just an amazing shot, right? I mean, like, people, it's not even about how many people. It's not even about thousands of people. It's generating consistent support over time to get them to their goal. I mean, these guys want to be there past the winter, right? They are committed to stay there for the winter. And I think it's just a huge thing.
Yeah, I'm, and what I like about it is it's not, it's so far it hasn't taken on a very, self-interested position. Like, I want all my student loans forgiven. It seems to be the whole conversation where everybody's included, and it's not dividing people, because so much of our politic is dividing young and old, white and black, union, non-union, white, blue collar, whatever. Slicing and dicing us nicely. This is not doing that, in my opinion, yet. I hope it doesn't.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly right. And I think that that's why it's generating the buzz that it's generating. And I think people are saying to themselves, you know, we're talking about labor organizations coming in and being supported. I think it's bigger than that. It's not just about labor organizations. It's about regular people as well, low-wage workers that are really just have had enough. And that's what we want to convey. We want to convey everyone. You know, we have other organizations that are helping. The Working Families Party has been involved from the beginning. They've had organizers. They're on the ground organizing, you know, with the young people who have, like, committees. I mean, it's a pretty amazing thing. It's everybody out there really making a difference.
Well, I can't wait to see what happens on Wednesday. This coming Wednesday, the Beyond May 12th Coalition is going to have their march. They're going to be a bunch of other folks, and I can't wait to see what happens. Camilo Rivera, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
No problem. Take care. Bye-bye.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Come to talk.
Do you know any of the dozen Congress critters who are on the super powerful deficit reduction super committee? I don't mean do you know their names, but do you really know them? Know them well enough that they'll take your call? This is one congressional committee that's likely to affect your life, for it's going to decide such things as whether to whack your Social Security benefits or cut back on Big Oil's $4 billion a year taxpayer subsidy. You might have an opinion about which choice the super committee members should make, but can you reach any of the members personally and get a chance to bend their ear? No? Too bad, because Big Oil can, and it is. So are insurance giants, Wall Street bankers, and other corporate powers, not only because of their big dollar campaign donations, but also because they have some very special lobbyists who are on a first-name basis with the members. You see, these lobbyists used to work for the 12 lawmakers on the super committee. About 100 former congressional staffers have now been hired by various corporate interests to lobby their old bosses. General Electric, for example, has 8 lobbyists on board who previously were on the staffs of super committee members. They include the head of GE's Washington Lobbying Brigade, who had been the chief of staff for Senator Max Baucus. Indeed, Baucus's Senate office seems to have been a training ground for influence peddlers. A couple of dozen of his former aides are now lobbying him and the other 11 deficit whackers to protect the subsidies that oil, insurance, and other corporations receive from us taxpayers. As one congressional watchdog dryly notes, it's not like the 12 members are in an idealized platonic debating society. This is Jim Hightower saying, indeed not. Once again, the game is rigged for those with the money and the connections to play inside. And they wonder why Congress and corporate lobbyists rank below E. coli bacteria in public approval ratings.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Absence works. Maybe it's the way it's being taught or the way that it's being applied out there. But the fact of the matter is, it is the best form of to teach our children.
I want to be a cowboy, and you can be my cowgirl.
Yeah, I wonder if anyone bought the 6-foot Rick Perry chia pet. The Governor Good Hair Chia Pet, only $4,500 on eBay. It would look nice. You know what you could do with that? You could have a fundraiser, a smash the chia pet. Yeah, give him a good shot to the snaz. There you go. Well, Herman Cain tried that today. Rick Perry apologized. He said that, he apologized for saying that Republicans who oppose in-state tuition breaks for undocumented children don't have a heart. And I got to be honest, I agree with Governor Goodhair on this before he apologized. He said, I was probably a bit over-passionate by using that word, and it was inappropriate. He did say that he stood by the DREAM Act anyway, but I got to be honest, he should have stuck to that, because I would have agreed with him on this. So Herman Cain sees this opening that the Governor Goodhair has put out, because now he's kind of backpedaling a little bit. And Cain says, he was asked by Wolf Blitzer if he could support Governor Goodhair, and Hermie said, today I could not support Rick Perry as a nominee for a host of reasons. Him being soft on the border is one reason. He went on to say that it's more important to empower the states to enforce the national federal immigration laws, because the federal government didn't do it, can't do it, and never will do it. So our good guy, Herman, the McCain train there, again, Mr. Constitutional Scholar.
We don't need to rewrite the Constitution of the United States, rewrite it. We need to reread the Constitution and enforce the Constitution. And I know that there are some people that are not going to do that, so for the benefit of those that are not going to read it because they don't want us to go by the Constitution, there's a little section in there that talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
No. Got to reread. I think you should not reread, Hermie. You should actually read it. But again, you look at this whole thing with the with immigration, and it's one of those things that just kind of makes you go, what's wrong with these people? And I really love our compassionate, conservative, family values Republicans. You got to love them, because several Republican congressmen, they have put forth a bill. And I can't believe that I'm actually going to say these words. They put forth a bill giving authorities the ability to deport undocumented immigrant women who are the victim of domestic abuse. If they get beat up and they call for help, they're going to be deported. Texas Representative Lamar Smith is... hinder the Administration Legalization Temptation Act. I don't even know what the hell that means. But it's HALT. It's the HALT Act. And what it would do is it would force immigration officials to deport any woman who reaches out for help in a domestic violence capacity. And you look at this, and Smith's rationale, he says, well, this HALT Act, it's necessary. It's necessary because Obama, he's seeking a backdoor amnesty. Yeah, I'm sure backdoor is something you know pretty well there, Lamar. Jerk. But here's the thing. You've got advocacy groups. You've got police groups. You've got all these people speaking out saying, look, how can you possibly turn the victim, make this person a victim twice? What's going to happen is people are just going to take the abuse, and you're going to put these women in an unwinnable situation where they're going to end up with people who are going to beat them, knowing that there's nothing they can do. And according to women's rights advocates, this could actually repeal some of the protections under the 94 Violence Against Women Act. So again, as a father of two girls, I think about that. And what we've done is really we've dehumanized people, be it Muslims, be it Hispanics, be it blacks. We've done an amazing job of dehumanizing people. And I read this story today from Nashville. I cannot imagine being this kind of a scumbag. Police stopped this woman, a Hispanic woman. Her name is Juana Villegas, 33-year-old woman, wife, mother of four children. She's also an illegal immigrant. She has a consulate card. She has a registration for the vehicle. She stopped. Police say, well, you're undocumented. What legal officials are saying is she should have been given a simple written citation. They knew who she was. She had a consulate car. She wasn't here without us knowing it. We knew. Did I mention she was 9 months pregnant? They arrested her. On the way to the police station, she goes into labor. They take her to the hospital where they handcuff her to the bed. Both hands handcuffed to the side rails where she sat for hours. 2 hours before the baby comes, they then let her take her arms out, and they put her arms back after the baby is born. I stood and watched my wife go through labor 3 times. Personally, and I think I speak for all men, I would have gone through it maybe once. There would have never been child 2 or 3. Pain, agony, all of those things. I think I speak pretty. There's no way you're getting a basketball coming out of me. Here is this woman that they handcuffed to the bed, writhing in pain. This childbirth is not, it's not like it's in the movies. Oh, yay. Hours of labor. And I asked the question, where's our humanity? This woman asked, please, uncuff me. I'm not going anywhere. Please. And the cop said, no, don't feel like it. No, I don't feel like it. And I look at this and I go, you know, what does that say about us as a nation? I mean, this cop should be fired. Undoubtedly. But what have we done? So I asked my wife, I sent her the story, and I said, what do you think about this? Maybe I'm overreacting. Maybe my wife is the one who went through it 3 times. Maybe I'm just overreacting. So she writes me back. She says, I think it's completely inhumane to put a woman in handcuffs, a laboring woman in handcuffs, at all. She said, like she'd really be able to walk away. And to keep handcuffs afterwards, just nuts. Did she even get to hold her baby? That's an interesting question. Did she get to hold the baby? She writes the sheriff, say, well, a backside. I don't know that I can say the A word. But you know what I mean. She says, to be honest, too much else on my mind to type. And she said, I would actually say she was arrested because she was Hispanic. Would they have done this to a white woman? And that's an interesting question. And I would have to say the answer is probably not. But what does it say about us, Jake? What does it say about our humanity? What does it say about that cop? What does it say about the doctors? What does it say about the entire system that allows that to happen?
We've allowed ourselves to be dehumanized in some areas. They have become the enemy. And it's easier to hate somebody and think of them as perhaps not as human as you, if you consider them the enemy that many accuse as being a key factor in taking away jobs from true Americans. And in that context, I totally disagree, and I think this, I agree with you, this cop should be fired. But I understand it from a certain perspective, given what's going on in this country, and that is absolutely sad.
You understand it from what perspective?
I understand it from the perspective of the propaganda coming from certain people in our society who blame many of the ills of society and those coming across the border are undocumented. From that perspective, I can understand. I don't agree with it, but I understand that they can arrive at the attitude that, well, you know, they're not as good as we are. They're not quite as good a human being, therefore.
Well, I'm glad you can
justify. Well, I understand it.
I'm glad you can, because I sure as hell can.
Well, my point is, it is what it is. And the cop reacted because of what he's hearing from a number of sources in our society, and that's sad.
Just nuts. So there you go. Let's take a break. When we come back, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, back after this.
Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Big news in D.C. today. That's why I've asked Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, to come fill us in. Victoria, big news. They've passed the unanimous consent, the spending bill, I think 4 whole days?
4 more days. Yes. Hugely exciting. They actually passed it by unanimous consent in a session that was 5 minutes and 46 seconds long and consisted of, I believe, 3 people.
So
they did it.
Oh, 3 people. Okay, I was going to say, anything more than 2 or 3 people, I was going to say that would be something to celebrate, something that everybody agreed on in the room. That would be pretty remarkable.
Yeah, what they actually had to do was, one guy proposes it, and then they had to stay silent for about 2 seconds, and there was a little bit of nerves because they were afraid that some tea partier might come rushing in and say, I object, but it didn't happen. So they had their 2 seconds of silence, and then, yeah, it's passed by unanimous consent, and then somebody takes it off wearing white gloves, and off it goes. So we're okay until Tuesday, and then they hope that they'll get it done until November the 18th.
So we've got to worry about Tuesday. That could be the next hostage situation. And then most certainly November 18th, we'll be right back with the drama and the cliffhanging drama there of the time ticking away and the government shutting down and all that.
Oh, I think so. I think November the 18th is going to be pretty bad, actually, and I think it's going to be compounded because November the 23rd is the deadline for the super committee to come up with its cuts. It's $1.25 trillion worth of cuts, or let's put it this way, of deficit reduction, whether it's cuts or cuts and revenue increases. So, that's just a 5-day difference. So I think it's going to be a hugely pressured November.
No turkey for them for Thanksgiving if they
don't
get this done.
None.
No cranberry sauce, no mashed potatoes, no stuffing, nothing.
No bread and maybe a little gravy.
No, not even that. Just bread and water.
Bread and water, yes.
So we've got to look at the 2012 draft budget.
Yeah, this is not the in full draft budget. This is the draft budget for labor, health, and education programs. It's a $153.4 billion measure from the House Appropriations Committee. And it's very interesting.
I would imagine if it has anything to do with workers or health care or education, I'm sure it's going to be your typical Republican cut, gut, and punish bill. I can't imagine it having any increases or any future investments.
Actually, it has a $1 million increase for NIH.
Wow.
Yeah, it does do that. A $1 billion increase for NIH. And Head Start gets a $540 million increase. So that's good.
I stand corrected.
So both of those get increases, but there are a number of cuts.
Ah, got to have the cuts.
Yes. Deep cuts are being made in aid to Hispanic education institutions. The bill seeks to block the administration from proceeding with health care reforms at all, and to rescind $8.6 billion in related appropriations already authorized under the Affordable Care Act. On labor relations, something I know is important to you, the National Labor Relations Board sees its budget cut by $49 million, which is 17% reduction. And the bill adds multiple funding restrictions to block rulemaking related to union elections and organizing activities.
Well, you got to give them credit. They're petty at best.
It also cuts heating subsidies for the poor.
They can just all hug each other. That's good enough.
Yep. By $1.3 billion, or 28%.
Jeez.
It plans to zero out Title X family planning program.
Yeah, because we need more kids.
And cuts all funding for NPR.
Well, you knew that was coming.
Absolutely. It cuts off Pell Grants after 6 years instead of allowing students to receive them for up to 9 years. There are all kinds of different things. So there are a lot of issues here that, involving green jobs. It blocks appropriations for the Labor Department's Green Jobs Innovation Fund.
Well, like I said, 2012 is 1980 all over again. Carter started the whole solar panel wind kind of thing, looking for alternative energy. And the first thing Reagan did when he took office, rip out those yuppie solar panels or those hippie solar panels and throw them into the museum and go back to good old fashioned oil and gas. I see us going right back to that again here in 2012 if Republicans take power.
Well, that's the question. Are Republicans going to take power? And there's a new poll out talking about enthusiasm in voting, and the enthusiasm in voting, according to this new Gallup poll, 45% of Democrats say they are excited about voting, 44% are less excited, 58% of Republican voters are more excited about voting this time. 30% are less enthusiastic. So that's 13% higher for Republicans than for Democrats. So, this is not good.
Nope. I just keep thinking Anthony Kennedy and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, not getting any younger.
No, exactly. And I think Democrats have to think about that, and there's going to be a Supreme Court decision next summer about the Affordable Care Act, and it will be a major decision going one way or the other, about its constitutionality.
Yeah.
And so Democrats have to think about that.
Yeah, I mean, if you get one of the Snow White and one of the other seven dwarfs in the White House, I guarantee you get somebody along the lines of Roberts, Alito, or Clarence Thomas, or Scalia, or any one of them, or maybe worse. And then pretty much this country is down the wrong path for another generation.
I think with any of these candidates, get a justice along those lines.
Yep, absolutely. Big news in the banking industry. I see they're raising fees on checking accounts. Now, I guess Bank of America is going to start charging debit card fees?
Yeah, Bank of America is going to charge a $5 monthly fee.
Wow.
Rolling out early next year. Now, the timing, of course, is interesting because beginning October the 1st, the new regulation goes into effect, which was worked out in Congress, which caps the fees that banks can collect from merchants whenever customers swipe their debit cards.
So they're just transferring the fees from the merchants to the consumers.
Right, which is what they had threatened to do.
Well, you know they're going to.
Yeah.
I mean, any way they can, you know, they can twist a couple of bucks out of you. And they've even said, well, you know, if you're going to limit our way to earn, we're going to make up new ones.
And the fee will apply to basic accounts, which are marketed towards those with modest balances and will be in addition to any existing service fees.
Yeah, well, you know, look, you stick it to the people who need it the most. Amazing. Let's move on. I guess the another big news is the Obama administration's looking at immigration laws in different states.
Yeah, this is very, very interesting. The Obama administration is escalating its crackdown on tough immigration laws. Justice Department lawyers are reviewing four new state statutes to determine whether they should take what's really a pretty extraordinary step of challenging the measures in court. Now, the Justice Department already sued Arizona and Alabama. And in Alabama, as you know, yesterday, a federal judge allowed key parts of that state's immigration law to take effect. But now federal lawyers are talking to Utah officials about the lawsuit and are considering challenges in Georgia, Indiana, and South Carolina. And this is considered, according to legal experts, highly unusual, particularly because civil rights groups have already sued most of those states.
Yeah, well, at some point, the federal government's going to have to step up and take care of this. I mean, I don't know if you saw this story in Tennessee where the cops picked some woman up for, you know, driving without a license. They deemed her to be here in an undocumented fashion, and they arrested her, 9 months pregnant, and they had her handcuffed to a bed until 2 hours before the baby was born. I'm going, you know, is that who we are? I mean, is this how we're going to treat people?
Wow.
I mean, I can't even imagine that you've got this woman handcuffed to a bed and she is, I mean, it's just mind-blowing to me.
Why was she handcuffed?
Because she's illegal. She's a criminal. We've arrested her. And that's what we do with criminals. We handcuff them to the bed.
Wow.
And then they re-handcuffed her a couple hours after the delivery to the bed. Because, you know, she's a flight risk. You know, 9 months pregnant, she's going to get up and run. It's nuts.
That's extraordinary.
But it's what we've done in this country. We've dehumanized these people. We've dehumanized the folks in the Middle East. We've dehumanized the people who are here, the workers here in an undocumented fashion. So these stories don't upset many people. Lastly, I guess someone at the General Services Office got a big surprise when they went to the bathroom.
Yeah, two people did, actually. Two toilets exploded, literally blew up into tiny showers of porcelain. Actually, they seriously injured two federal employees.
Wow.
And it was rather bizarre. It's very rare. Apparently, the accident started in a water tank on the roof of the GSA's Capital Region headquarters Monday morning. And, of course, the story's gone viral. It's very weird. This sort of thing doesn't happen. In fact, this particular sequence of events that happen is considered so rare that it's in textbooks on plumbing, but it's never witnessed by anybody in the trade. They're saying that the tank's control system malfunctioned, plunging the water level below normal, allowing air to seep into the pipes. And the air hit the toilet bowls when they were flushed. The result was not pretty, and the toilets exploded. And but the incident is under investigation, and we don't know why it happened.
Yeah, see, I was going to say, if this was the Bush years, that would be considered a terrorist attack, and we'd be under lockdown. It would be code red right now. Fear, scare everybody.
Department of Homeland Security does use those offices.
Or maybe it was just somebody with an M80. Yeah, I mean, they used to do that when I was a kid in school. I haven't heard that in a while, but when I was a kid in school, occasionally some smart aleck would pull something like that. And, well, different era.
Different era, absolutely. Yes.
Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Well, apparently when we think this scenario involving the city of Harrisburg is going to calm down for a little bit, upsprings another story. Apparently, there's some infighting between the city council and the mayor's office. Harrisburg's acting solicitor, a man by the name of Jason Hess, has now told city council that they're hiring of the Philadelphia area lawyer Mark Schwartz to defend the city against the state takeover is invalid because he did not sign off on the resolution to hire Schwartz before it was introduced. Council has hired Schwartz in its legislative meeting on Tuesday night. In response, Mr. Schwartz said this. He said, under Act 47, the governing body is the council, and the mayor and her solicitor don't have anything to do with this. The sad thing is, as this is a matter of sovereignty of a city, Mayor Thompson should be on the same side as council. They need to be on the same team. So apparently these two, again, are at loggerheads over the legality of his hiring. He's basically saying that the city solicitor has no legal standing. I mean, this political drama involving the bankruptcy just keeps going on and on and on, and it's almost comical, although the situation itself is dire. So I'm sure there'll be more developments concerning that issue and the city bankruptcy. As we talked a little bit, Governor Tom Corbett's approval rating, surprisingly to me at least, has gone up. A new Quinnipiac poll says that the favorable rating for the governor has risen to about 50%, mainly by strong support from women. The poll also shows that about 62% state voters feel the economic boost from Marcellus shale natural gas drilling outweighs the environmental problems. 54% support imposing a tax on gas extraction. Voters are 2-1 in favor of privatizing the state liquor stores, but they oppose privatizing state parks by a slightly wider margin, which is good news. I think it would be an absolute terrible mistake to privatize the state parks. A corollary survey on U.S. Senator Pat Toomey finds that only 43% give him an approval rating. There have been some sentences up in Luzerne County for the man who owned the jail that the two convicted judges were sending kids to. He was convicted. He hasn't been sentenced. His sentencing is scheduled in November. One judge, Caravello, got 28 years. The Conahan, the other judge, got 17 and a half. This man should be serving a very stiff sentence. I mean, he's no less guilty. And I hope that justice isn't served, and he serves a long, long sentence, which he absolutely deserves. We had talked about the big fix from time to time, but apparently as time goes on, the governor is starting to feel some pressure. He's getting pressure from all sides. He's getting pressure literally from Washington about his proposal. He's getting pressure from the state party chairman. He's getting pressure from some congressmen, Republican National Committee. The two Republican National Committee people from the state are saying, you know, Tom, you better back off. You better maybe give it some more thought. The two people who are pushing it, by the way, are very well known, Charlie Giroux and Robert Jubiler. Robert Jubiler was at one time probably the most powerful man on Capitol Hill up until 2006. He got caught in that pay raise scandal, was voted out. Charlie Giroux is a political strategist. There's a third ingredient in this. The governor is going to have some hearings next week on public opinion as to what are their thoughts on his ideas for the presidential election. Apparently there's a New York billionaire by the name of Tom Gilisani who has come up with the idea that he has a national popular vote initiative, and according to him, he's got measures passed in several important states that agree with him on that procedure. He's talking about California, Maryland, and let's see, another state in there, Illinois. And all three of them have, under certain conditions, on conditional basis, have accepted his proposal. I, for one, would not have any problem with that. Now, whether they can get it, it remains to be seen. One last report. We've been talking about Jean Orie and her corruption case. She has been charged with using public money for political purposes. Back in March, she came to trial. There was a mistrial called. Well, now, apparently, Allegheny County District Attorney Stephen Cipolla said he's having state police experts examine Republican state Senate computers because some files related to the corruption case against the state senator were deleted after her mistrial in March. So apparently now there's at least a tacit accusation that perhaps she's guilty of even more charges than she's facing. And if she's convicted on even half of what she's charged with, she faces years and years in prison. So we shall see. Back to you, Rick.
All righty. Well, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and wrap this all up. Stick around. Right back after this.
Rick Smith.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the anti-immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in Labor's Forgotten Massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer Massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what he said. I'm so in love with you. Yeah. Interesting study just out. Again, you look at this and you look at these people who, the abstinence only crowd. New study says that the majority of young evangelicals, they have premarital sex. Oops. Evidently, according to the study, 80% of unwed evangelical young adults have done the nasty, which is only 8% less than the general unmarried adult population. So for all of the purity pledges and all of the abstinence-only pledges and all of the browbeating and all of the repression and all of the nonsense that goes on with this, not much difference. But what we are seeing, much higher rates in teen pregnancy. You look at Texas, abstinence-only state, third highest teen pregnancy rate in the country. And I know Rick Perry says it works. See, I know it works. We're just not applying it right. See, just not applying it right. Yeah, dum-dum. You're not applying it right because, you know, and it's hard to, and I know probably a long time since you were a raging teenager there, Jake, but things happen. Even back in the Stone Age, which is why I'm here. You know, you can't get much more stigmatized than when my mother was a teenager. But you know what? It still happened. And I still, you know, and I wrote in the Labor Day piece I had published, you know, my grandparents, you know, after World War II, they got married, as my grandmother said, because they had to. And, of course, the old wives' tale is that, you know, the first child always comes early. Could come as early as 3 or 4 months. And all the other ones stick to a strict 9-month gestation period. But that first one, that's a little tricky, you know. 3-4 months after the wedding day, because, of course, everything was conceived on wedding night. But, I mean, are you surprised? I mean, really, is there anybody who's surprised when you look at the fact that all of these pledges, all of this stuff, all of the abstinence only, and you get Bristol Palin? Anybody surprised? Everybody surprised? Raise your hand. Nobody's surprised. Just insane. Let's talk real quick about a couple of stupid things I came across. You know, rich people, they're dumb like the rest of us sometimes. Somebody sent me this article of some dumb insurance claims that rich people throw out. And it was kind of in regard to what I was saying the other day, that we seem to consistently bail out rich people. They do dumb things. They build a house on the ocean. Their house gets washed away. We rebuild them a new one. The Rube Goldberg claim. He's the guy who invented all those really bizarre machines that the ball drops and goes here and there. Turns out a $50 million+ painting fell off the wall. How a $50 million painting falls off a wall is beyond me, but it lands on a $4 million 18th century chest of drawers, cracking the marble top. As the painting fell, it knocked the $6 million Rodin bronze and a pair of 18th century porcelain candelabras to the floor, crashing them. The arm of the Rodin broke off, piercing the $1 million carpet and denting the floor beneath. So you look at this, $50 million for the painting that was ruined, $4 million for the chest of drawers because you had to get some out of that, $6 million for this. And, you know, at some point, you should have probably had someone who could have screwed it into the wall better. Amazing stuff. But we bailed them out. Nice check. Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests today. Thank you for listening. We will be back here tomorrow, same time, same channel. And, of course, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, smartphone, Stitcher. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the bitter sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy's coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.